Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 20, starting in verse 1. I'll go all the way through verse 29, the entire chapter. We're going to call this chapter The Death of Miriam and Aaron. Moses strikes the rock at Kadesh Barnea, and Edom refuses passage to the Israelites into the Promised Land. Our context is this in Numbers 19, the previous chapter. We examined the ordinance of the red heifer, the ashes of which were put into water and used for purification rituals. So now we start in verse 1 of Numbers 20. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. Now then the sons of Israel, this is a huge jump for about 38 years. They've been wandering around for 38 more years since they took off from Mount Sinai, and now this is in the last year. And it was not a good year. It started out with Miriam dying. It ended with the death of Aaron. Then it contains the tragic conflict with Edom, that centuries-long conflict that went on and on and on. And the chapter centers on Moses' sin, which kept him out of the Promised Land. So this is not a good year. The whole congregation came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month. That would be Nisan. Now, the wilderness of Zin is between the Dead and the Red Sea. If you're at the southern tip of the Dead Sea and you go west a little bit, that's the wilderness of Zin. You go south a little bit further down the Araba Valley, that rift that goes between the southern end of the Dead Sea down to the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the tip of the Red Sea, from the Dead to the Red, the Araba. If you go south down the western side of the Araba Valley there, the next thing you will hit is the wilderness of Paran. That's at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Then if you go even further south and maybe a little bit to the west, you end up with the Sinai Peninsula or the Sinai Desert there at the northern end of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the scholars debate where Kadesh Barnea is. It's somewhere in that area between the Dead and the Red Sea, southern end of the Dead, the northern end of the Red Sea, northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba, somewhere in there. The wilderness of Zin is north of the wilderness of Paran. I saw one scholar locate Kadesh right there at the border between the wilderness of Zin and the wilderness of Paran. However, BibleAtlas.org has Kadesh Barnea at the northern end of the wilderness of Zin, right south of the Negev Desert, which is moving on up into Israel. So I don't know exactly where it was, but it was somewhere in that desert. And it's an interesting place because that is where the spies returned to after their trip into the Promised Land, Canaan Land, and came back and said the spies were too big for the Israelites to take the nation. And that was 38 years earlier. And now they're at Kadesh again after wandering around for 38 years. Just south, somewhere south of the tip of the Dead Sea, not in the Promised Land yet. Now, our verse here says it was the first month. It doesn't say the first month of what year, but we can deduce it's the first month of the 40th year since leaving the Exodus, not since leaving Mount Sinai, but since leaving Egypt. It's been 38 years, roughly 38 years and maybe 8 months since leaving Mount Sinai. But since leaving Egypt, it was 40 years. We know that because of Numbers 33, verse 38. Then Aaron the high priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day in the 5th month. So Numbers 33:38 says the first day of the 5th month, Aaron goes up to Mount Hor. Here it just says the first month, but we can assume it's 40 years after leaving Egypt. Now, as I said, that's not the same thing as after having left Mount Sinai, after having built the tabernacle at Mount Sinai. It was 8 years after that. How do we know that? Because in the first year, it took them a year to get to Mount Sinai. So that leaves 39 years to go before Aaron died. And then it took them a couple months to leave ER 20, the second month, 20th day, in that 39th year. And then they spent a month or so eating quail and so forth. So you're talking about a fraction of a year there is leaving 39 years to go. That is in the 39th year, so the rest of that 39th year and then 38 years after that. So you round that off, you get about 38 years. Clark says 37 years. I don't know why he says that. I hadn't figured that out yet, but 38 years is close enough to that. Now, we see also in Deuteronomy 2:14 an explicit reference to the 38 years. Now, the time that it took us for us to come from Kadesh Barnea until we cross over the brook Zered. That's the brook Zered is the southern end of Israel, promised land. The time was 38 years, Deuteronomy 2:14. Now, I mentioned that Kadesh was the scene of the Israelites' great rebellion after the 10 spies' bad report. NIV Study Bible says the people may have roved around Kadesh looking for water, depending on manna, for 38 years. Or maybe they went around in a circle. They've come full circle. But once more, they're ready to enter the promised land, just as they were 38 years earlier. Now, I mentioned it was a hard time figuring out where Kadesh was. There's also a question of whether Kadesh is the same as Kadesh Barnea. Huge, difficult, scholarly, archaeological problem. I'm not competent to get into that issue. But for my purposes, they're in the desert, south of the Negev, waiting to get into the promised land. And then in verse 1, it just very calmly says that Miriam died. Now, Clark points out that Miriam appears to have died with Aaron and Moses in the space of 1 year. If we assume Miriam died in the first month and Aaron died in the fifth month from the verse I just quoted you in Numbers 33, so they died within probably 4 months of each other. That's kind of sad. And then we're going to see Moses dies very shortly here before they get into the promised land in year 40 since the Exodus. So the whole family is wiped out by age. We go now to Numbers 20, verse 2. There was no water for the congregation. They assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. Now, this incident is very similar to an incident 40 years earlier when the Israelites had just left Egypt and they went to the Rock of Horeb, which is in the Sinai Desert, which is basically Mount Sinai, probably, at a place called Rephidim, which is about a day's march from Mount Sinai, just to the north of it. And so since these two places get confused, at least they do in my mind, I'm going to read you the account at Rephidim. Remember, this is 40 years earlier. It's in Exodus 17, verses 1 through 7. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin. The wilderness of Sin is in the Sinai Peninsula on the western part, on the Gulf of Suez, not the Gulf of Aqaba, on the Gulf of Suez, about halfway down the peninsula. That's roughly where Rephidim is. According to the command of the Lord, encamped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Quarrel and test. Massa means test, and Meribah means quarrel. That's what they're going to name this place later. But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Sounds like they think Moses is deliberately trying to murder them. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people, and take with some of you the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb." Remember, Horeb is another word for Mount Sinai. Or actually, it's not. Some people think that. Some people don't think that. It could be a range, but anyway, it's a rock there, and it's going to be called Rephidim, and that's what we're going to call it, this rock at Horeb, this rock in the mountain range of Horeb, this rock called Rephidim. "And you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massa, which means testing, and Meribah, which means quarrel, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord. Quarrel, test. Tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Now, we need to remember that because we need to distinguish that from what happens here at Kadesh Barnea 40 years later, roughly 40 years later. Now, there was at Kadesh a place called En Mishpat. When Abraham was joined up with the kings of Sodom, the four kings, to fight the five kings coming in from Mesopotamia, we read about En Mishpat at Kadesh. Then they, referring to the five-king coalition from Mesopotamia, turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon Tamar. And again, that's referring to that area west of the Araba Valley between the Dead and the Red Seas. Now, that well was gone, probably because it dried up by the heat of the season, or maybe so much of the multitude had drunk the water. It was not there anymore. They were short of water. So En Mishpat is not going to help them 40 years later from when they first named it. We go now to Numbers 20, verses 3 through 5. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord." Oh, what a great desire. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Same thing as at Rephidim. It sounds like they're complaining to Moses and saying that Moses deliberately brought them into the wilderness to die, which of course is an absurd, slanderous charge. Verse 5, Numbers 20, why have you made us come up from Egypt? Made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place. It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. Well, these people that are contending with Moses conveniently forgot all the great things Moses had done for them, as John Gill points out. They didn't condole Moses for the loss of his sister Miriam. All they do is bitch, moan, and whine. Great bunch of people. If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. We wanted to die with them, say they, such great heroes. Now, what could they be referring to? Three options here. There was a fire at Taberah right after they left Mount Sinai. Right after they left Mount Sinai, they had the rebellion of Korah and his 250 leaders, rebels who were all killed by fire, God's fire. And then after that, there was 14,700 people killed by a plague, by a pestilence, because of their rebellion, trying to take over the priesthood from Aaron and Moses. Let's look at those three options. Numbers 11, 1 through 3. Now the people began complaining openly before the Lord about hardship. When the Lord heard, his anger burned, and fire from the Lord blazed among them and consumed the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So that place was named Taberah because the Lord's fire had blazed among them. Taberah means burning. So that's one place the people were saying, I wish we'd have died at Taberah. Perhaps. We don't know exactly what they're talking about, but it could be any one of these three places. And then, of course, Korah's famous rebellion, Numbers 16:35, fire also came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were presenting the incense. Those were the people that came, that were standing with Korah in that rebellion. And so 40 years later, actually 38 years later, the sons of these people, the next generation, is moaning and groaning. They wish they had died in the wilderness rather than come to this horrible place. And as far as the killing of 14,700 people by pestilence, they wish they could have died there, perhaps. Numbers 16, verse 49. But those who died from the plague numbered 14,700, in addition to those who died because of the Korah incident. Now, it's amazing to me that the Israelites hadn't learned their lesson. Now, it's true, these are the sons of the original Israelites. These are not the same Israelites, but it's amazing how soon we forget. How soon we forget the judgments of God. People just naturally think, oh, I can do what I want, and the world's going to be a bowl of cherries. I don't need God. I don't need him to forgive me for my sins. I don't need him to protect me from the catastrophes that are everywhere in this veil of tears on the planet Earth. Now, notice I said that when the sons said, the sons of the fathers of Israel, the younger generation said they wish they would have died. That's the same complaint that their fathers had made at Rephidim. Exodus 17:3, we read this. But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Note that the grumblers acted like Moses intended to kill them, which of course is a ridiculous charge. Now the sons didn't quite make it as explicit as that. Is why did you bring us here to kill us? Why have you brought us from Egypt to kill us, said their ancestors, the fathers. In order to kill us, pretty explicit here. It just says, why have you not brought us out here to die? So it's not as explicit, but the idea is the same. You killed us. You're killing us, Moses. And then, of course, in verse 5, why have you made us come up from Egypt, Moses? You made us. Yeah, like Moses put a gun to their head and said, leave Egypt. They all left Egypt because they were leaving slavery, and they were glad to go, and they went voluntarily. Moses didn't make anybody leave Egypt. Such utter nonsense. We go now to Numbers 20, verses 6 through 8. Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beast drink. Now in verse 6, going to the door of the tent of meeting is where Moses and Aaron often went to hear from God, the Shekinah glory hovering over the tabernacle, or either inside the Holy of Holies above the Ark of the Covenant. They were at the doorway, which would mean, I guess, that the inner veil and the outer veil of the tabernacle were open so that they could see God and hear what he had to say. But at any rate, they fell on their faces. It could be the Shekinah glory is hovering over the tabernacle. The glory of the Lord appeared to them. That's the Shekinah glory from from which cloud the Lord often spoke to Moses and sometimes to Moses and Aaron. Now, why did Moses and Aaron go to the tent of meeting? Well, it could be they went there for sanctuary from the enraged mob, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest, because the people would not have the guts to chase Moses and Aaron into the courtyard next to the holy tabernacle where people have been known to die by violating God's rules. So maybe they went in there for sanctuary. Maybe it's just because they wanted to go there to ask God for direction, which is reasonable, or it could be both. God tells Moses to take the rod. Now, that's the same rod with which he disobediently struck the rock in just a minute. And I'll give you a preview of the discussion we're going to have in a minute. Since Moses was told to take the rod, isn't it understandable that he struck the rock with the rod? God didn't think it was understandable. He says, Moses, you can't go into the promised land for what you're doing here at Kadesh Barnea. What rod was it? Well, that was Aaron's rod. I'm sure that it had been deposited in the tabernacle. Remember, there was a contest of the rods. All the tribes had their rods out there with the tribal leaders' names on the rod. And then Aaron had the rod of Levi with his name Aaron on it, and his rod budded, and the other people didn't. That means Aaron was chosen by God to be the high priest, Aaron and his sons, his family. And to drive the point home, God had told Moses and Aaron to put the rod into the Ark of the Covenant so it would be safe there as a perpetual testimony that Aaron, the high priesthood, would be in the family of Aaron. So now Moses is to get this rod. Now, of course, you know, Moses gets some special dispensation here, probably. John Gill points this out a lot, that Moses was not, by law, allowed to go into the tabernacle. He was not a priest, but he would go in there on certain occasions. And here God gave him special permission to go into the Holy of Holies to get that rod. Now, why did God want Moses to have the rod when he spoke to the rock? Well, that rod was a symbol of Moses' authority. When he had done miracles with the Egyptians, he always had the rod. One time that rod had turned into a snake. And let's read that. Exodus 7:12, for each one threw down his staff, each one of the Egyptian magicians, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff, Aaron's rod, swallowed up their staffs. And this rod had alternate names. Sometimes it was called the rod of God, Exodus 4:20, Moses' rod, Numbers 20:11, or Aaron's rod in Exodus 7:12. It's the same rod. It's a symbol of God's authority. Numbers 20, verses 9 through 11. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beast drank. Now notice, Moses does exactly what the Lord had commanded him. That phrase is everywhere in the Torah, everywhere in the Pentateuch. What God said, Moses did, just as God had commanded Moses. Now, in verse 10, Moses said to them. Now, that said is a little bit plain vanilla. We can speculate that Moses was in a rage. The NIV Study Bible says, quote, at once the accumulated anger, exasperation, and frustration of 40 years came to expression. 40 years of leading these jackanapes in the wilderness, and he'd finally had it. Now, when we get to Deuteronomy 9, we'll read the whole sorry history of Israel's rebellion put in one chapter, in one page, as Moses recounts to the people all of their rebellion to remind them. So that, I think that's reasonable. Moses is angry. Now, that anger caused him to speak rashly, apparently. Now, again, this is controverted. We'll talk about it in a minute, but apparently, he's angry because he says, hey, you rebels, must we bring forth water for you out of this rock? This incident is referred to in Psalm 106, 32 through 33. They also provoked him, the Israelites also provoked him. Now, in the NASB, that him is capitalized, so that's God. The Israelites also provoked God to wrath at the waters of Meribah. So it went hard with Moses on their account because they were rebellious against his, capital H, spirit. Capital S, against God's Holy Spirit. He spoke rashly with his lips. So the NASB translators translate Psalm 106 in such a way that the children of Israel are provoking God, not Moses. However, we can look at different translations and see that it was very well Moses who was angered. Psalm 106, 32 and 33 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says this, they, the Israelites, angered the Lord at the waters of Meribah, and Moses suffered because of them, for they embittered his spirit, little h, embittered Moses' spirit, and he spoke rashly with his lips. There it shows that Moses spoke rashly because of the bitterness of his spirit, which was caused by the Israelites. Now, the King James Version has this in Psalms 106, 32 through 33. They angered him, little h. So the Israelites angered Moses also at the waters of strife, so that it went ill with Moses for their sakes, because they provoked his spirit, little h, little s. The Israelites provoked Moses' spirit so that he spoke unadvisedly with his lips. Well, so we're not clear from Psalm 106, but it looks, sounds like, at least a good case can be made that Moses got angry with the rebellious Israelites, and he spoke rashly. Now, of course, you would have to then interpret that his tone of voice is, "Hey, you rebels, do I really have to bring forth water for you out of this rock?" would be kind of how it would be read. Now, let's look at that. The "shall" there is the NESB translation, and some people say, well, shall we express, bring water out of the rock? Some people say that Moses is expressing some doubt that the water is going to be forthcoming. Not that God was not able to do it, but that God would want to do it for such rebels. Well, maybe so, but the Holman Christian Study Bible has it this: "Listen, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock for you?" In other words, this is an imposition on me to bring out water for you ungrateful morons. Moses calls them rebels. "Listen, you rebels." Now, that is an exact description of the Israelites here, the sons of Israel. In Deuteronomy 9:23, in that passage where Moses lists all the rebellions of Israel out, we read this: "When the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea," when the Lord sent you Israelites from Kadesh Barnea, saying, "Go up and possess the land which I have given you," then you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You neither believed him nor listened to his voice. When they listened to the spies' bad report, they were rebelling against the command of the Lord. So Moses was right. 38 years ago, the fathers rebelled, and now the sons are rebelling 38 years later. Now, we're going to get into some alternate interpretations of this as to why God would take this incident at the rock and deny Moses and Aaron entrance into the promised land. It's a difficult passage, but I'm going to suggest here tentatively that is Moses was angry, and God didn't like one of his leaders getting up there and acting angry and acting in the name of God with his rod, showing his authority, and then just blowing his cool. Verse 11 in Numbers 20, "Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank." Well, okay, God didn't deny them their water. He kept them going. He just punished Moses and Aaron. Notice the striking the rock. That's what Moses struck the rock once at Rephidim 38 years earlier. Now here at Kadesh Barnea, he struck twice. He was not told to strike the rock either once or twice by God. God just said, "Take the rod and speak to the rock." That's all he said, "Speak to the rock." Now, this splitting of the rock and the subsequent water that came out of it is referred to in Psalm 78:15. "He," that's God, "split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths." And of course, splitting the rocks, plural, the first one was at Rephidim 38 years earlier, and then Kadesh, or Kadesh Barnea, which is where we are now. We go now to Numbers 20, verses 12 through 13. "But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them.' Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them." Now notice that the rock here at Kadesh, 38 years later than Rephidim, they're called Meribah. The waters at Kadesh are called Meribah. So were the waters at Rephidim, and that can be confusing. But they're two different incidents. They're two different incidents. Meribah means quarrel. The sons of the original Israelites are quarreling with God. Verse 12, you notice that the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Aaron, you're not coming in either, along with Moses." Well, Aaron's exclusion from the promised land shows he participated in Moses' sin, whatever that sin was. So Moses and Aaron are both equally guilty here of whatever they did. So now let's come to the major problem here in this passage. Why did God punish Moses and Aaron so severely? Let's put ourselves in Moses' shoes and see what you would have done. First of all, he had used a staff to strike the rock earlier at Rephidim in Exodus 17. So wouldn't it be logical to strike the rock again at Kadesh Barnea? Second, God had told Aaron to take his staff to the rock, Numbers 20, verse 8, which we just read. "Take the rod," God says to Moses. And you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock. He says, take the rock, speak to the rock, but that's not the same thing as saying strike the rock, but it's close. And so you would think, well, you know, Moses would think, God told me to take the rod to the rock. I struck earlier a rock at Rephidim with the rod and water came out, so I'll do it again. So what has he done wrong? Not to mention the fact that the people were acting like perfect horses' asses. Why shouldn't it be reasonable for Moses to be angry at these people? And so there's the rub. Why was God so harsh on Moses and Aaron? Now, there's a scholar at Gordon Conwell, and I don't know his first name. In fact, I'm not familiar with this scholar. His name is Beck, last name. And he states in this article, a good article that I pulled off the internet, he said that rabbis and scholars say this is one of the most difficult problems of the Torah, of the Pentateuch. So let's look at some options as to why God did what he did. Now, these options are not mutually exclusive. It could be one, two, or three, or all of them. Perhaps, so we'll see. Option number one, Moses wasn't showing trust in God. Now, you notice in verse 12, God actually says that. Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me, which is the same thing as saying you have not had faith in me, because belief is another word for faith. Now, how did Moses not believe God? Well, apparently he didn't think speaking alone would do the job to get the water. He had to strike the rock too. God had told him to speak, and he struck. The NIV Study Bible adds here that Moses had used the staff before and that had worked. Maybe Moses thought the rod had magical powers and he was depending upon the rod and not upon God. But at any rate, God explicitly says, you didn't believe me, Moses. Now, the application there is, oh my goodness, it's best to believe in God. And a lot of times it's hard to believe in God because we walk by faith, not by sight. Because we in our sin walk by sight and not by faith. And it's real hard to believe in God. But Moses was supposed to, especially because he's a leader and rank has its greater responsibilities. But here's another possible option as to why God was so strict with Moses. Moses had not shown proper deference to God's presence, as the NIV Study Bible suggests. He was acting rashly and in anger, and in his anger he struck twice instead of once. He wasn't deferring to God's holiness and majesty there. Especially when he's in a leadership position where everybody could imitate him as a role model. Third option as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron. Moses violated the order to speak and struck with the rod instead. That's John Gill. That's very similar to what the NIV Study Bible just said. The problem with that is, why did God tell Moses to take the rod if it wasn't to strike the rock? How are you blaming Moses for doing what God told him to do? Well, it could be that God told Moses to take the rod to show Moses' authority, not to strike the rock, because these rods were symbols of authority, like a king's scepter. So I guess that even though he had a rod, he still violated God's order to speak to the rock, and so he disobeyed God in a public situation. Next problem with this idea that Moses was punished for striking the rock instead of speaking is, if that were so, why was Aaron punished? He didn't strike the rock with the rod. But he got just as punished as Moses. Well, it could be they were operating together. One of them took the responsibility for the other. I don't know. Fourth possible reason why God was so strict on the leaders of Israel, Moses and Aaron. This is John Gill's suggestion, or at least he quotes somebody saying this. Moses unjustly called the Israelites rebels. Now, this can't be it. God himself called the Israelites rebels. In Numbers 17:10, God says to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels. And not only that, Moses called the Israelites rebels in Deuteronomy 9. You Israelites have been this is verse 9, chapter 9, verse 24 of Deuteronomy. You Israelites have been rebellious against the Lord from the day I, Moses, knew you. God doesn't chastise him there. I don't think there's any problem with calling the Israelites rebels. They were rebels. Here's the fifth option as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron didn't give credit to God. They took credit for themselves. The we in verse 10 shows Moses and Aaron taking credit for themselves. This is suggested by John Gill, Numbers 20, verse 10. Moses and Aaron summoned the assembly in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock for you? We, Moses and Aaron, your leaders, we're going to bring the water out of the rock. Not God, but we are. You know, it probably would have been better if Moses had said, listen, you rebels, must God bring water out of this rock for you? But no, he says, must we bring water? So that some people speculate that Moses and Aaron are taking too much credit upon themselves. Here's a sixth option as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron in his punishment. It could be they did something that's not recorded, and Moses, in writing the text here, covered it up to preserve his and his brother Aaron's reputation. Well, that's getting into some serious accusations with no evidence. I don't think I'm going to go there. Here's the seventh option as to why God was so strict. Moses spoke rashly and harshly to the people. And this option says it wasn't God that was so upset about his rash talk as the people were, and that's bad leadership. Well, I don't like that because the people deserved it. Like I said, they were horses' rear ends. How they say, hey, Moses, you're trying to kill us. Wish we'd have died in the desert earlier. Stupid. Now, here's another option. Option eight as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron at this incident at the rock at Kadesh. God had told Moses to strike the rock once, but Moses struck the rock twice. Now, the problem with that, I don't see where God told Moses to strike once. He told Moses to speak to the rock, and Moses struck twice. So let's just say, all right, he struck instead of spoke. So two strikes on a rock will keep you out of the promised land? Really? That's a little strict, isn't it? Because Moses didn't directly follow instructions? I don't think so. Here's the ninth possibility is why Moses and Aaron were punished so harshly by God. The shall in verse 10 shows reluctance or doubt on Moses' part. Numbers 20:10. This is the NASB translation. Moses and Aaron gathered their assembly, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Is it possible we can get water out of this rock? I really don't know. Lack of faith. And I've previously mentioned this. God directly said that they didn't have faith. You didn't believe. Here's another possibility. Option number 10 suggested as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron. Moses was distracted by the death of Miriam and showed callous indifference to the people's thirst. Well, speculation, speculation, speculation. Here's option number 11 as to why God punished Moses and Aaron so severely. Moses was afraid of the people and fled to the sanctuary rather than face them. He showed cowardice in times when he should have showed bravery and courage. Another nice speculation. Now, here's a good one here. Option number 12 as to why God was so strict with Moses and Aaron when he punished them. Moses had selected a rock other than the one the people wanted. And this made the people suspicious that Moses knew water was behind the rock he struck. And so the people doubted the miracle and thus doubted God, and thus God was angry. Now, this is an interesting idea. Perhaps Moses knew there was water behind the rock, and he was banging the rock to knock it loose so water would flow. And the people said, well, but you didn't go to the rock that we wanted you to. You went to this rock, and we think there was some finagling going on here, some skullduggery going on. Now, to back this up, Dr. Beck of Gordon-Conwell here has written something that shows that it very well could have been a natural reason that the water popped through that rock. Let's read this. Quote, rainwater that gravity forced through the soft upper courses of limestone would dissolve and transport components of that soft chalk down through the upper strata. This mixture of water and chalk would settle through the upper layers of limestone until it reached a less permeable layer. The water would then flow laterally and would at times exit the rock face. As the water flowed from the rock, evaporation would occur, leaving behind crystals that had formerly been dissolved in the water. Given enough time and the right conditions, a mineral cap would form, sealing off the flow. Of course, water would continue to collect behind its former effusion point under increasing pressure. This hidden water research awaited the blow from a shrewd water seeker who knew how to read the rock. A sharp blow would break the mineral cap and cause water to flow from a rock. So Moses, according to this theory, looked around, saw the crystals on the rock, says, ah, there's water behind there. I'm a smart cookie. I know how this works. I'm going to bang that chalk. I'm going to bang those crystals, and then the water that's been pent up behind those rocks is going to break forth. Now, of course, that would mean that Moses was guilty of conscious fraud, which I don't believe he would do, of course, but according to this theory, by not striking the rock the rebels wanted him to strike, he left himself open to the charge that he was playing fast and loose with the truth, that he was engaged in some kind of fraudulent trickery. So even if he wasn't committing fraud, if the people looked and said, well, you know, there was water in this rock anyway, and that was going to detract from the miracle, and God knows that, and he sees what Moses has done and said, no, you didn't have faith in me, you didn't believe, so you're not going to go into the promised land by trying to help me out with my miracles. You've harmed my honor. Now, the problem with this theory is that the same thing would have happened earlier at the rock at Rephidim. If Moses looked, found the crystals, and struck the rock at Rephidim so he could get water in order to use natural means to circumvent God's miraculous powers, the problem with that is that at Rephidim, 38 years earlier, God didn't complain when Moses struck the rock. So if he was striking rock crystals in order to get water that he knew was pent up behind the rock, God didn't care about it at Rephidim. So why would he care about it here? Well, there's an answer to that. The rock was solid granite at Rephidim. This is from Beck's article. The rock was solid granite at Rephidim. There's no way of striking the rock there would cause the water to naturally flow. It couldn't sink down through the limestone and collect in the lower strata of the rock. And that's a good theory right there. Let's look at reason number 13. Again, some of these reasons overlap, but option number 13 as to why God was so upset with Moses and Aaron. It was the people's sin, says this option, not Moses' sin that caused God's displeasure. They quote, this option quotes Deuteronomy 1:37, the Lord became angry with me because of you, referring to the incident of the 10 spies with a bad report. So Moses is saying, hey, what you do as my followers makes God mad at me sometimes. And you people are rebelling like crazy at Kadesh Barnea before the rock. And so that's why God's upset. But the problem with that is why would Moses and Aaron be punished for something they didn't do? It was the people's fault. So I don't like that option. So you see there, this striking the rock at Kadesh Barnea has caused a lot of theological ink to be spilled. In my humble tentative opinion, I think it's because Moses lost his temper, banged that rock, and started yelling at the people and didn't act with a dignified leader's demeanor, thus bringing disrepute upon himself and also God too, for that matter, because he was representing God. We go now to Numbers chapter 20, verses 14 through 17. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left until we pass through your territory. Now Moses is trying peaceful negotiations to deal with the problem of Edom being in their way. Remember now, Edom is to the south of the tip of the Dead Sea, and then as you go east of the Dead Sea at the southern end, up maybe, a third of the way or so, maybe half the way is Edom. Actually, it's probably about a third of the way. Moab, going up that east side of the Dead Sea, is the next territory, and then when you get near the northern end, you got Ammon, traditional enemies of Israel, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Now, Moses not only sent messengers in order to engage in a peaceful negotiation with Edom, he even offered to pay them if they even drank water in the well, as we'll see in a minute. Well, actually, as we just saw in verse 17, as I read it, Moses said, we won't even drink water. And as a result of these peaceful feelers from the messengers, from the diplomats, there was an arrogant rebuff on the part of the Edomites. No, you're not coming through. Now, Moses tells the messengers to say, thus your brother Israel has said, how are the Edomites Israel's brothers? Well, remember, the Edomites were descended from Esau, and Esau was the brother of Israel, Jacob being their common father. Now, the messengers are to tell Edom, you know all the hardship that is befalling us. How would Edom know about the hardship that had fallen upon Israel? Well, they were a neighboring country. Remember, Israel's right to the south and west of them across the Arabah Valley there. So they're close by. And besides, Israel's exodus was famous all over the ancient Near East there. So yeah, the Edomites knew what had happened to the Israelites, all the hardship that had fallen to them. Now Moses is trying to appeal to the Edomites' pity. Oh, your brethren, the Israelites, had a hard time. How about give us a break? And Moses continued, or the messengers are to continue along that line. Our fathers went down to Egypt. We were slaves there, and we stayed in Egypt a long time. Now, that long time is disputed as to actually how long the Israelites were in Israel. I just assumed it was 215 years when I was going through this in Genesis, but I found a paper, a blog post, actually, by an Old Testament professor named McCabe, and he's quoting another paper by a guy named Riggs, and he says this, quote, Riggs thoroughly presents three views about the duration of Israel's sojourn in Egypt, a sojourn of 215 years, another of 400 years, and one of 430 years. Now, this is a bodacious theological problem. McCabe takes the 430 years view. I'd already decided that 215 years is right when I did my audios on Genesis, but I just want to show you that that is a humdinger of a theological problem. And conservatives, people who respect the scripture, disagree on exactly what the number is. Now in verse 16, the messengers, in talking to the Edomites, are to say that God heard the Israelites' voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. What angel brought Israelites out of Egypt? Well, a couple of options. It could have just been an ordinary angel that God sent, according to John Gill, or it could be Jesus himself. I tend to think it was Jesus himself leading the people out. Although there's no statement in the scripture anywhere that says that Jesus was leading them out as the angel of Jehovah. So the messengers finish up with their message to Edom, and they say, behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. And that's, if you look at the map, wherever Kadesh is, wilderness of Paran in the north, wilderness of Zin in the south, wilderness of Zin in the north, wherever it is along that western side of the Araba Valley, they're on the edge of the Edomite territory, and they would have to go east over the Araba Valley and then north straight through the center of Edom. Please let us pass through your land. We won't pass through the field or through the vineyard. We won't drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway. In other words, we won't trample your crops down. This king's highway is a major north-south trade road in Transjordan. Transjordan is the area east of the Dead Sea. I've been in this area. There's a long mountain range along the eastern side of the Dead Sea. Nasty red sandstone-looking mountains, not a tree on them, desolate. And then right to the east of that mountain range are the countries, Edom in the southern end, Moab in the middle, and Ammon to the north, and beyond the northern end of the Dead Sea, those three countries. Now, that King's Highway today is, the bed of that highway is used by Jordan's Highway number 35, and that highway runs right by the famous city of Petra. I've been on that highway. Long, straight highway, nicely paved, oil trucks. That's all that runs up and down that highway is oil trucks and tourists going to Petra. And basically, I think the idea is the King's Highway runs right through Edom, and the idea is that if they stay on the highway, they're not going to be trampling down vineyards or trampling down crops in the field or drinking water from wells. This King's Highway, according to Adam Clark, appears to have been a public road made by the king's authority at the expense of the state. What state? Well, that could be Egypt, perhaps. I don't know. I'm trying to search my mind to figure out who was in charge of that area in the 15th century B.C., and I can't recall. I don't know. But anyway, it was a government road that went through there. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the encampment of Kadesh was on the confines of the Edomite territory, as we know, on the east there, across the Araba Valley, through which the Israelites would have had an easy passage across the Araba by Wadi el-Guir so that they could have continued their course around Moab and approached Palestine from the east. If they could have just gone up that road, they would have gone up the road, then they would have gone, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown say, around Moab, maybe even through Moab. I'm not exactly sure of the geography, but it would have been a simple trip if they had just been allowed to use that highway, but they weren't. We go down to Numbers 20, verses 18 through 21. Edom, however, said to him, one of the messengers, and Edom, of course, is not speaking as a country, is referring to the king or a chief diplomat. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, that's the messengers, we will go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through with my feet, nothing else. In other words, we're not going to hurt you, just let us go through. But he, that's Edom, whoever was representing Edom, said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him, against Israel, with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus, Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. Now, as it turns out, in Deuteronomy 2, 4 through 6, we can see that Israel was forbidden by God to take even a foothold in Edom. And, of course, passing through means they're not going to take any territory. They were actually forbidden by God to take territory. Of course, the Edomites don't understand that, but if they had have understood it, they probably would have let them through. Deuteronomy 2, 4 through 6, God commanded the people, saying, "You will pass through the territory of your brothers, the sons of Esau, who live in Seir." Mount Seir is the mountain range east and south of the Dead Sea. Moves on down south toward the Gulf of Aqaba on the eastern side, on the eastern side of the Araba Valley. So you're going to pass through that territory of Seir. They will be afraid of you, so be very careful. Do not provoke them, for I will not give you any of their land, even as little as a footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. So God says, don't take not even a footstep of that land are you going to take. And God tells them, you shall buy food from them with money. This is in Deuteronomy 2:6. You shall buy food from them with money so that you may eat, and you shall also purchase water from them with money so that you may drink. Now, here in Deuteronomy 2, it says the Israelites will pass through the territory of Esau. That's Edom. King James has passed through the coast of your brethren, which means you'll pass through the side. And I think that's what they did. They skirted. They didn't go up the king's highway right through the middle of Eden. They had to go further east and get out into the desert and then go north so they could bypass Edom. We read in Judges 11, verse 18, then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom. There's your skirting of Edom and the land of Moab. So they went to the east, went up through the desert. It would have been so much easier if they could have gone on the highway right through the middle of the city, of the countries, Edom and Moab. Judges 11, 18, continuing, and they came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon. They did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. If you look at the map, the Arnon River runs right through or right across the northern boundary of Moab, separating Moab from Ammon. So they went around Edom, around Moab, around Ammon, then they cut back west right north of the northern tip of the Dead Sea and went through Moab across the Jordan River into Israel. That's where they eventually ended up. But Edom forced them to make this circuitous path. Now, many people say that there was retribution against Edom for forcing the Israelites to do this. Retribution coming in the times of Saul and David. We read concerning Saul in 1 Samuel 14:47. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, kings of Zobah and the Philistines, and wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. So Saul inflicted punishment on Edom. David did the same, 2 Samuel 8:14. He, David, put garrisons in Edom, and all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants to David. Well, that's good news for the Israelites, but it doesn't specifically say that it was in retribution for what they had done. Many people think that it was indeed for retribution, but it doesn't say so. But at any rate, we know that there's just been centuries-long animosity between Edom and Jacob. We go to their patriarchal ancestors. Edom's ancestors were Esau. Israel's ancestor was Jacob. And Esau and Jacob hated each other, fought each other, cheated each other. And now Edom is giving trouble to the Israelites. And later on, I might point out, Edom, according to what many scholars think, assisted the Babylonians in their attack on Israel in 586 BC. And many people think that's what Obadiah is complaining about, is he calls down curses on Edom's head for unnamed offenses, but that's probably what it was. At any rate, Edom and Israel have got a strong bone to pick with each other. Now, the messengers offered for the Israelites to pay if they took any water from the Edomites. Why would you pay for water? Because water was scarce in those regions, and therefore it cost money. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "In the warm climates of the East, the practice of levying a tax for the use of the wells is universal, and the jealousy of the natives in guarding the collected treasures of rain is often so great that water cannot be procured for money. It's priceless." Now, in verse 20, the text says that Edom, verse 20, Edom came out against him, against Israel, with a heavy force and a strong hand. So they made a military presence known and forced Israel to go around them. Now, let me play the devil's advocate here. and ask, can we blame Edom for being so fearful? Remember what happened to the Trojans when they trusted the Greeks. The Greeks says, oh, we've got this nice present for you, nice big horse. And inside the horse were soldiers who eventually were going to open the gates and destroy Troy. I mean, it takes a lot of trust to trust military adversaries. And it seems to me that Edom had every legal right to protect themselves militarily. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, though every king has a right to refuse passage through his territories to any strangers, yet in a case like this, and in a time also in which immigrations were frequent and universally allowed, it was both cruelty and oppression in Edom to refuse a passage to a comparatively unarmed and inoffensive multitude who were all their own near kinsmen. In other words, the Edomites could have just watched them go by. They could have had their armies put on the side of the road to say, let go through. Now, if you're going to come off that road, we're going to come after you. After all, it's not like Israel had a huge army. They had God on their side. That's why they won all these battles. But it's not like they had a meticulously trained army, well supplied and staffed. So, at any rate, we can't justify what Edom did. They shouldn't have gone against the Israelites. Now, Adam Clark makes the point that it wasn't all the Edomites that were unfriendly and cruel. It was only the Edomites of Kadesh that were unfriendly and cruel. We read in Deuteronomy 2, verse 26 through 29, so I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, that's east of the Sea of Galilee, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land. I will travel only on the highway. I will not turn aside to the left or the right. You will sell me food for money so that I may eat, and give me water for money so that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot. Verse 29. Let me pass through on foot. Verse 29. Just as the sons of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for me. The me there is talking about Moses. So the sons of Esau who live in Seir, let them through, just like the Moabites did, until I cross over the Jordan into the land which our Lord God is giving to us. So apparently it wasn't all the Edomites who were nasty to the Israelites, just the ones right there at the entrance to the land. But they went around those, and apparently they ended up going back through Edom. I don't know how long this skirting operation took, how far it went before they got back into the land of Edom and kept going, because apparently it says the sons of Esau let us pass through on foot in Deuteronomy 2, verse 29. Now, I mentioned earlier that Obadiah said some nasty things about Edom because apparently the Edomites helped the Babylonians in their attacks on Jerusalem, not only in 586, but also in 597. Jeremiah unloaded on the Edomites too in Jeremiah 49, verses 7 through 22. But Holman's dictionary says there is no clear evidence to support this view that the Edomites aided the Babylonians. So it's a speculation. Now here's an interesting question. Were the Edomites ever rebuked for refusing Israel passage? I'm pretty sure that one cannot prove that Edom was ever rebuked for this. I haven't been able to see it. I know people assume it. It just seems to me that the scriptures relate constant conflict between Edom and Israel. The scriptures never seem to assign blame for a particular action that Edom took. If you read Holman's dictionary on Edom, I think you'll probably come to the same conclusion. But now Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, on the other hand, explicitly say that David and Saul's victories over Edom were retribution for what Edom had done. So again, the scholars argue over that one. We go down to Numbers 20, verse 22. Now when they set out from Kadesh, the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Now Mount Hor, nobody knows exactly where it is. I got two possible places on Bible Atlas map. One is, let's see, south of the tip of the Dead Sea, 100 miles or so? I'm not exactly sure of the scale of this map. But south of the Dead Sea and then east across the Arab Valley on the edge of that mountain range I told you about that runs from the east side of the Dead Sea all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. In that mountain range is Mount Hor, according to one possible place of Mount Hor. Another possible place is on the east of the Dead Sea about, I don't know, maybe a third of the way up from the southern tip in a hill range there on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. Doesn't really matter. What matters is that Aaron died there, as we'll see here in verses 23 through 29 as we close up this audio. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron will be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. That you there is talking about you, Moses and Aaron, rebelled. Take Aaron and his son Eleazar and bring them up to Mount Hor and strip Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar. So Aaron will be gathered to his people and will die there. So Moses did just as the Lord had commanded, and they went up to Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. After Moses had stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on his son Eleazar, Aaron died there on the mountaintop. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. When all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days. Now, Aaron is not going to enter the land. He's going to die. Got a little application point here. Aaron represents the law because he's the high priest. The law is not going to be effective in getting anybody into the promised land because the law didn't go into the promised land with Aaron. That might be a little strained, but I think it's applicable. Now, we've already talked about how the sentence against Moses and Aaron entering the promised land seems harsh, and we tried to look at some reasons why it was so harsh. Here in verse 24, it says, the reason is you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. Rebelled is a strong word. Well, how did Aaron rebel? It's because he assisted Moses when Moses struck the rock twice instead of speaking to it. Now, I said, doesn't that seem a little harsh from Aaron's point of view? Let's see what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about that. Quote, although the time of his death was hastened by the divine displeasure as a punishment for his sins, the manner of his death was arranged in tenderness of love and to do him honor at the close of his earthly service. His ascent of the mount was to afford him a last look of the camp and a distant prospect of the promised land. The simple narrative of the solemn and impressive scene implies, though it does not describe, the pious resignation, settled faith, and inward peace of the aged pontiff. Jameson Fawcett and Brown call Aaron a pope, the aged pontiff. Well, that's nice. I guess he had a nice funeral up there on the mountain. Of course, Eleazar takes over as the high priest because he's Aaron's oldest surviving son, Nadab and Abihu, having been killed for offering strange fire a long time ago back in Genesis. And now the Sagan, the backup priest, will be Ithamar, the youngest surviving son. Eleazar and Ithamar were the two surviving sons of Aaron. Now, the garments Eleazar took off, these were the garments that were put on Eleazar. Well, that were taken off of Aaron and put on Eleazar. These are the garments that Aaron wore as high priest, and they were put on Eleazar at this, his inauguration into high office, because this was his inauguration as the high priest. There's no mention here of anointing of oil, but Jameson Fawcett Brown say Eleazar had previously been anointed, so there's no need to repeat. I don't have the site here, but if you go back to Leviticus, I forgot where it is exactly in Leviticus, but when they were doing the anointing of the priest, Eleazar and Ithamar were anointed right along with Aaron. Or it could be that Eleazar was anointed again upon his return to camp, even though it's not mentioned. That's speculation, but it doesn't matter. Eleazar is now obviously the new high priest. Verse 27, so Moses did just as the Lord had commanded and went up to Mount Hor, etc., etc. Once again, we see Moses, the faithful servant in God's house, doing just as God commanded him. Not one bit to the left, not one bit to the right, but just as he said. Verse 29 says very simply that Aaron died. When all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, John Gill says he died, quote, quietly, comfortably, and contentedly, without the least murmuring or repining. His death was on the first day of the fifth month, and again, that's in the 40th year since they left. Numbers 33:38 says this, then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day in the fifth month. First day being Nisan. Well, the fifth, I don't have the fifth month. I forgot what the fifth month is. But that's when he died, and he was buried there right on Mount Hor. We see that in Deuteronomy 10, verse 6. Now the sons of Israel set out from Bereth beni Jaakan to Moserah. There Aaron died, and there he was buried, and Eleazar his son ministered as priest in his place. Now it says, when the congregation saw that Eleazar had taken over, and when they saw that Aaron had died, the question is how did they see Aaron had died? Aaron's way up on a mountain. They're looking at the mountain from a plane. How can they see that? Well, it's easy to explain that. As John Gill says, they just saw that when Eleazar came back, Moses came back, there's no Aaron with them. So they would put two and two together. Aaron's gone. And plus, they probably saw Moses and Eleazar's grief. They're probably long-faced, sad, maybe even crying, whatever. He's gone. Aaron's gone. Now, Moses and Eleazar were the sole witnesses of Aaron's death. And here's a problem. The new high priest could not be present at the funeral of his father without being defiled. We know the law, Leviticus 21:11, nor shall he approach any dead person nor defile himself even for his father or his mother. That's the high priest. A regular priest could do that, but not a high priest. So how is Eleazar up there with Aaron dying without being defiled? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the law was dispensed with in the extraordinary circumstances here. Well, that's interesting. I don't know if that's the right answer or not. Now, this little ceremony is an indirect proof that the earthly Canaan was not God's highest intent to bless man, because Aaron didn't make it there. Moses didn't make it there. The earthly Canaan is nice, but remember, Abraham went out looking for a country that has found sure foundations, but not looking for a town that could be seen, a city that could be seen. The best men were excluded from earthly Canaan, but they're not excluded from heaven. This is Adam Clark quoting the great Lightfoot. Now, the 30 days that the people mourned, this is typical. That was the typical mourning period for dead people. The people would mourn for 30 days. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 20 of Numbers. In our next audio, we'll take up Numbers chapter 21. We'll do verses 1 through 20, the first part of Numbers 21. We'll look at the bronze serpent that the Israelites looked at so they could be healed. And then we'll look at the Song of the Well. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.